So the film is about two detectives, Somerset, who is about to retire, and then a young, brash, and idealistic detective, Mills, played by Brad Pitt.
Not Leonardo DiCaprio.
Not Leonardo. As Taylor figured out about halfway through this movie, that it wasn't Leonardo DiCaprio in this movie. Can you explain that?
Yes. Now, when I remember this movie, I picture the what's in the box scene being done by Leo DiCaprio for some reason. Well, so when we see Brad Pitt enter, and I had a very quick, oh, that's right, moment.
And we're back.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, guys. Woo. Welcome back to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast. I am Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
How's your week been?
Been good. Good week at work. Good week over the weekend. Got to see a friend yesterday.
Excellent, excellent. Cliff?
Bit drippy, dreary, rainy weather, mm-hmm. which is very on point for the movie we're going to be talking about in a smidge.
That is a very good point, yeah. It's been kind of a rainy week here in Austin, and boy, is it a rainy, drippy movie we are seeing today. We saw Seven, mm-hmm. following up our Seven Samurai podcast from last time. We are now seeing Seven. We will only be seeing movies with Seven in the title, perhaps. I don't know if one of them gets programmed, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
Wow.
Maybe we'll see that. No, we probably won't. No, it's just a weird coincidence because, mm-hmm. As you know, this is the Crowded Theater Podcast, the only podcast where all the movies are seen in theaters. We do not cheat. And then we saw that Seven was playing. And Seven was a significant movie for Cliff and I growing up in the 90s.
It was a Nine Inch Nails music video.
It was.
In feature length form.
Yeah, so we were the perfect age. I was 10 in 1995 and super into Nine Inch Nails, so this movie would have been perfect for me then, I think. And this movie was even featured, I remember, in Fangoria. And this was during a time when we did not see a lot of Hollywood movies with Hollywood stars featured in the pages of Fangoria, because there weren't a lot of horror movies playing in theaters back in the mid-90s. So this was as close as we got. As close as we got to being able to go see a big horror movie with stars in it was Seven. And it was pretty cool, I remember, I think. Taylor, what was your first experience seeing Seven?
I saw Seven for the first time alone in my apartment quite a few years ago, maybe over a decade ago.
Good. That sounds like a fun viewing experience.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It was one of those movies that I felt like I had to see as a movie fan to be able to say that I was a movie fan.
Of course.
And yeah, no, incredible movie. And then obviously we're very excited to have seen it in theater.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
what was your impression the first time you saw it?
At the time, I didn't have a very big scope for like quote unquote horror or scary movies. Not to say this is necessarily a horror movie.
Did you enjoy it when you saw it?
I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it a lot. I thought that it was definitely more of an evocative movie than I had seen up until that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely stayed with me a lot. And I definitely can see why other stories might have like a pivoted mm-hmm. off of that. I've been inspired by that one because it just feels
sure.
so almost even fanficy in nature that you could just kind of write your own version
sure.
of that.
It is definitely a high concept serial killer crap has been in our culture for the last.
And at this point, although it was certainly not the first, I think Seven stands historically as like the archetypal, you know, police chase, weird, fucked up serial killer movie.
Yeah, it's like the direct midpoint between Silence of the Lambs and, you know, whatever kind of low, like kind of trashy TV hour-long procedural equivalents exist these days, etc. And it's sort of right there in the middle because it's high art and it is also has a crazy concept that ties it all together. And I mean, having actually, you know, lived through that moment, it was a pretty a kind of universally ubiquitously influential movie aesthetically, as that David Fincher look became, which was very MTV anyway and very gritty and textured and very new, suddenly became very, very hip. And over the course of the next few years, films got greener and more kind of weird and washed out.
This color.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like Cliff's flannel is a
very yellow green.
That's right. You know, The Matrix was obviously very green, but I just remember that was a whole thing, especially with the early days of digital cinematography. It's like you could make things look all fucked up and green looking, and then you could just pawn it off on going for a Fincher-esque aesthetic of some kind, and it sort of worked. So. But I don't know.
Time for a comeback. That look. Don't see stuff like that these days. Yeah.
But this was pre-digital Fincher. This was shot on 35mm Fincher. This is 1995 Fincher. This is Fincher with the full, robust production, having to execute all of these things for real, in reality, without being able to like add trees and take away bullshit and with CGI, as he's so fond of doing these days. And boy, it is a robust-looking movie. Holy shit. We are in this, kind of just depressing hyper-reality.
The City of Sadness.
Yeah, City of Sadness, that's right. Which, in a weird way, interestingly, to connect it to another film we just talked about, Gremlins. Mm-hmm. Andrew Kevin Walker was saying he was living and very depressed in New York, just like Chris Columbus was when he wrote Gremlins, and just like Chris Columbus, this was sort of his love letter to what living in New York was like. So, not unlike... it sounds like New York is a very charmed place to live.
Much whimsy is happening in New York.
And I think not unlike Chris Columbus, he had mentioned coming from a suburban setting into New York and kind of reacting to it and it kind of being quite overwhelming. And what's interesting about the movie, and we'll get deeper into this as we go, is that while the film is strongly evocative of a crazy Gotham-esque New York, or the pop cultural idea of like New York as just being this sort of sewer full of street trash, it's never explicitly named as New York.
I was about to say, is it New York? Because I got more of even a Chicago-y type of vibe from it occasionally.
It's never explicitly named as New York, and quite evocatively, there are many things like desert being existing just outside of it, and other ideas that make it a city that exists kind of outside of reality and outside of geography and time, and which I think is a critical part of understanding the meaning of the movie, is that it's not quite a real city. It's not quite anything real. But Cliff, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was just going to mention the desert thing.
Yeah, the desert thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just so there's all sorts of things. They do say upstate at one point, but it again exists in this weird, kind of surreal projection of what existing on the street level of some sort of contemporary weird sin-ridden Gotham would be. And I think that, as cool as that is, and certainly when we were looking at it in the 90s, it was just, man, this film was full of a lot of cool production design and cool cinematography and strong aesthetic choices that would then come, of course, to be, very influential. This and Fight Club, Fincher became very, very hip, and a lot of people were trying to rip him off. And his aesthetic was also permeating the culture through music videos and all kinds of other stuff at this point. But... that surreal New York, it works for a film that doesn't literalize many different things. Like, we never actually see the murders taking place. We never actually see even the infamous, head in the box, spoiler alert, as we'll get to. What's in the box? Everyone knows the movie from the what's in the box line. There's a lot that isn't literalized. That could very easily be literalized. You don't even notice it's not literalized. You don't even notice that it doesn't call itself New York. You don't even notice that you don't see the head in the box. Most people think you do. You don't even notice that you don't see the murders taking place. And I think a lot of that, in an interesting way, ties into a question that you kind of have to answer right from the get-go in the movie, which is, whose movie is it? Is it Somerset's movie or Mills's movie? And I think, rather definitively, it is Somerset's movie. And there's some strong choices that I noticed just in this screening, really, for the first time, right in the beginning, that tee up the way in which it is Somerset's movie. Somerset, of course, and just to kind of give the overview. The Morgan Freeman character. So, of course, we're talking about Seven, directed by David Fincher. Very hip and influential movie experiencing in 1995, starring Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, and eventually Kevin Spacey, who enters into it a little bit later on, as well as Arlie Ermey and just a whole bunch of cool people. John C. McGinley even pops in there. really cool cast. The concept, of course, is that there is a serial killer killing people in accordance with punishing them for the seven deadly sins. So initially a man is killed for sloth. He is a big, fat, slovenly man. Another man
that's
is
gluttony there.
Oh, sorry, not so you're right. You're absolutely right. Sorry, gluttony. See, I'm already fucking it up. And then of course, a wealthy lawyer is killed for greed in a Merchant of Venice style way, where he cuts a pound of flesh from himself, blah, 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 blah. So all of these ironic, moralistic deaths are happening, and as the serial killer, not unlike the Zodiac Killer, who David Fincher would go on to later make a film about anyway, toys
the closest
with the
real life analog. To this
yes,
dude.
For sure. And so and if I sound a little bit snotty, it's because we're all recovering from colds here. But don't worry, you won't catch it from listening to this podcast. So, but I will take a few extra minutes to sip my tea intermittently. So you'll all have to bear with me. Taylor, say something interesting about Seven.
Yeah. No, it is a very, really good movie. Like you're saying with the different deaths, I think each death is very creative and very iconic in themselves. I think when you're talking about them, I think you can really even just talk about each and every death within more detail, just to kind of milk at each one.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%. No, I think that's definitely the thing, the concept that ties a film that is therefore free to explore all kinds of deep characters, explore a whole world, explore a whole interesting conversation about sin and about God and heaven and hell and where is God in the 90s, something that many of, I think, the best films of the 90s attempt to answer in this hyper-materialist kind of godless world that seems on the surface to be doing okay, but is it? Films like everything from, Shawshank Redemption to Forrest Gump to even Pulp Fiction are asking that same question at right around the same time, which is, where is God in all of this? Where is spirituality in all of this? And Seven asks that question, but it asks it very much from the negative. It's sort of like, in this world so replete with sin, where is God, or is there, what is the spirit of, is there a kind of spirit of justice, and what would that even look like other than some sort of menacing, avenging angel at this point, considering, especially I'm sure if you're a suburban person like Andrew Kevin Walker was living in New York at the time, you are living in a very hellish world, a purgatorio of some kind. But sorry, to get back to where we were a minute ago, so the film is about two detectives, Somerset, who is about to retire. She's days from retirement.
One week from retirement.
Yes, just like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. He is days from retirement. And then a young, brash, and idealistic detective coming from the suburbs, not unlike Andrew Kevin Walker, played by Brad Pitt.
Not Leonardo DiCaprio.
Not Leonardo. As Taylor remembered about halfway through this movie, that it wasn't Leonardo DiCaprio in this movie. Can you explain that?
I just have a very bad recognition of different actors and faces. It's just always been something that I've struggled with. When I remember this movie, I picture the what's in the box scene being done by Leo DiCaprio for some reason. Well, so when we see Brad Pitt enter, and I had a very quick, oh, that's right, moment.
Well, in fairness, we do watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a lot around this here, so we have probably just...
Yeah. They didn't have Leo, so they got a stunt double.
That's right. So Mills plays the young, brash, idealistic detective who, we haven't mentioned yet, his wife, Tracy, is played by Gwyneth Paltrow as she was emerging.
Pre-goop
Gwyneth Paltrow, yes. And I think she was actually dating Brad Pitt, so there's some gossip at the time.
Spicy.
Or they dated after this movie or something like that. I just remember that being a thing at the time. But he has a young wife who's having trouble adjusting to the city and all of that. But as the movie goes forward, and this is, I really kind of want to point right to the beginning of the movie. To finish out with the two characters of Mills and Somerset before we get too abstract with it. A serial killer starts killing people. There is the gluttony death. There is the greed death. They discover the two of the seven deadly sins by a bunch of circuitous clues scrawled both behind a refrigerator and then in blood on the floor of the lawyer's office. And they realize that there is something big and profound that is happening in these last 7 days of Somerset's career, this big and profound biblical event. Now, what is the meaning of this event? On the one hand, there is a crazy serial killer. Somerset is the wiser detective who seems, for some reason, you know, interested in understanding the greater meaning in a way that makes sense, going all the way back to the kind of, again, Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon, Manhunter tradition of the detective putting himself in the head of the serial killer and all of that. But we were talking about how so much is not literalized in this movie. The name of the city, certain things that happen, so much of the violence, which all happens off screen and all of that. And we get some insights later into the movie into something that I think is teed up right from the get-go, which is the fact that this is Somerset's movie and that this is Somerset's purgatory. This is Somerset's hell, his inferno, that Somerset is the sinner, that Somerset is, and as we meet him, he is incredibly cynical, he is jaded about life, he is jaded about the world, he doesn't have even that kind of a Morgan Freeman-esque sort of rosy and wise perspective whereby he sees the better in things. No, he is a very, very jaded, and he has lost faith. He has lost faith in the world, he is cynical about the nature of the world being this fallen place. In fact, he, as we will find, shares, non-coincidentally, quite a lot in common with John Doe. They actually seem to see the world in very similar ways. And then, as we learn later on in the film, in an important scene when, as Tracy, the wife of the young Mills, is having difficulty adjusting, she, in a kind of way that almost breaks the plausibility of the reality of the movie, she calls up Somerset, the partner, and asks him out to a lunch and a diner scene, and she confesses that she is pregnant to him, except she's confessing to him as go ahead, were you gonna say something?
I was gonna say I understand where you may come from, it kind of breaks the plausibility. I, as a once lonely woman, I think there is a very true nature to, if she is truly, like, she doesn't have any friends, she doesn't, it doesn't sound like she has a job per se. So it really does, I understand.
No, I agree. I'm with
you.
I like
plausible
the scene
that she's like, you're very nice, and honestly, and Somerset, and it'd be a different thing if Somerset was like a jaded ex-cop that was like gruff. Like, he clearly is a very soft guy. He clearly has a big heart, etc. So I think it makes it a little bit more plausible. She's like, can I just talk to somebody that's not my husband that also doesn't not give a fuck?
Yeah, no, 100%. I say that only because, it makes total sense within the world. I only say that because as she is telling him this story about them struggling and being pregnant and all of that, and Somerset shares what I think is a key to kind of decide the kind of Dakota ring of the whole movie, which is he says that he once had a young wife and she once got pregnant, and he thought that the world, because he was a detective, was so jaded and so evil and so bad that he wore her down, and there's an implication that he wore her down to the point where she got rid of the pregnancy and they decided to not have a family, to not create life, to not take that next step because the world was such an awful place. And in that, we realize that there is some sin that is haunting Somerset, some next step in life he didn't take because he became so jaded about the poisonous nature of this evil, evil world, confronted with it every day as he was as a detective. But instead of seeing, as Mills does, as we see the young idealistic Mills do, and Mills, and this is the point, is that he's sitting across from Tracy, he is sitting across from his young wife that he had all those years ago. Mills is the young version of him. Mills is the young Somerset, the man who had this idealism that was crushed out of him by some experiences similar or indifferent to the experiences that Mills undergoes here. Some trial that his soul and his faith did not survive. And now, Somerset, who believes in the sunset of his life, that he is moving past these things, and they are long. Somerset, exactly. In the end of his life, the autumn of Somerset's life, he is thinks he's moved past these things, and yet now, as even as he's dying, if you will, he is now going to have to undergo his purgatory, his adjudication, his moral judgment for all of the sins and the lack of faith and the lack of family that he had. And in that way, Gwyneth Paltrow is both his ex-wife and the daughter that he got rid of and never had. This is why at the end of the movie, it is Somerset who sees the head in the box, and this is why we as an audience do not see the head in the box. This is also why we don't see John Doe ring the doorbell of Tracy's apartment in a whole suspense sequence where he sneaks in on her and all that kind of stuff, is because it's not literalized to that extent. It's not a movie about a prowler. It is a movie about, in this hellish backdrop, this surreal desert that doesn't really exist outside of any city like New York, that Somerset is being forced to confront the wrathful young man he was, the wife he let go, the daughter he killed, all of these things. And he won't be let go from this place, from this purgatory, from this hell, until he has faced those things. Mm-hmm. And we see that. And the reason I say all of that is it changes how one views even the opening minutes of the movie. Because the opening minutes of the movie, tellingly, are at first just a simple, unadorned, objective behavior study of this man, Somerset. Just shots of him waking up, taking his specific things, his switchblade knife, his badge, his gun, going out for the day, getting into an argument with a cop about, you're always asking those questions, Somerset. Did the kids see it? Who cares? He's dead. Blah. We get a little bit of who Somerset is. He looks more deeply into things. Then he goes back. We just watch him unadorned go through his day. He goes all the way back home. And the final shot before the intensely long Nine Inch Nails credit sequence, the final shot is, and then quite meaningfully, Somerset sits down in his bed, lays his head back, closes his eyes, and puts his head back as if falling asleep, and we push in on him because we are entering Somerset's head. We are entering his world. This is Somerset's retirement. It's his death. It's him slipping into the dream world. And the next thing we see is, appropriately but ironically, something that does not look like the world of Morgan Freeman, this nice old detective. We're seeing weird, crazy, postmodern fingernail clippings, fetuses in jars, Nine Inch Nails remix music playing, black and white photography, all of this bullshit. All of that which constitutes the corrupted interior of who? John Doe, this man who lives in moral condemnation of the grotesque, disgusting world, blah, 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 blah. So what do we now learn? And I believe the end of the film speaks towards this very powerfully. We now learn that John Doe is an aspect of Somerset. John Doe is Somerset's malevolent, judgmental condemnation of the world that was too evil to bring a child into, that metastasized into a demon that is as judgmental as Somerset is about the world, and now that demon has come to punish him for all of for the faith he lost, for the child he didn't have, for all of those different things. And when he has now, that's why we're lost in a city with no name. That is why we see that the violence is never literalized to the extent that we see it happening on screen. That is why, ultimately, if you see at the end, Kevin Spacey's character and Somerset have quite a lot in common and to discuss at the end, but it is all about Somerset confronting the life he chose not to have because the world is so, so evil. Mm-hmm. And he maybe will be forced to just redo these seven murders over and over again forever until he eventually is released. Maybe it is his, maybe he shows back up on Monday, because again, his last 7 days of his thing. Yeah. And does he say something at the end about not retiring or going back to the job? I can't remember.
He goes back.
He goes back. Exactly. And in that way, what does that imply? Oh, he's unretiring. No, it implies that he is in purgatory. He was perpetually in the last 7 days of his time before retirement. And he'll show up on Monday, and there will be Mills, and there will be the first gluttony case, and he will do it over and over and over again forever, because it is Somerset who is in purgatory, and until he learns the lessons and regains his faith and those things, he will do it forever and forever, because it's not a city that we're in. That's why it's all rainy and creepy, because it's hell that they're in. They're in purgatory. Hence all the Divine Comedy bullshit and all that. And again, that's also bears out in the middle of the movie when Somerset, again, Mills has dogs and a wife at home, and he likes baseball, and he's connected to human things. That's when we see him in his element. Whereas Somerset, when do we see Somerset kind of at peace and happy for the only time he's happy? When he's in a big library at night. They play Bach, and he's in the world of ideas, completely divorced from the gritty, disgusting, textured reality of the city. He's in the pure world of Platonic forms at that point, and it's just him who, and he's reading books about the divine, he's reading the Divine Comedy, he's reading Chaucer, he's reading all these biblical scholars. What other character in the movie would be really at home in a library at night reading about all of these things? We know, because we literally got the library book list as an important plot device. John Doe. Somerset is John Doe. John Doe is Somerset. Like, again, what makes Somerset happy? Researching these nice, clean, clinical letters, writing it all down, all of that, sitting in grand conceptual intellectual judgment of the world, but at an emotional distance from it. He doesn't go home to dogs and a wife and all of that. And who is the other character who is immersed only in a world of letters? Once we see the interior of his apartment, a giant glowing cross, books, all this other stuff, John Doe, played by Kevin Spacey. And that's why, again, at the end, Somerset is experiencing, again, that's, in a way, John Doe is envy, but he isn't envy at the end. It is Somerset who is envy at the end. John Doe claims that he is envy at the end, but he is only an aspect of Somerset, because the sad thing is, this whole fucking movie, Somerset is trying to stamp out the last little bit of hope from Mills, to prove that the rule by which he has lived his life to not have these things is right. And so he keeps telling him from this, and he's playing the role of the wise detective, but he is not wise. He is the least wise. He is the one being punished who can't learn this lesson. So he's telling him, yes, that's what you feel now, but soon you won't have any hope, and soon you'll be a piece of shit like me. You just wait and see, blah, 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 blah. And he eventually does it. He succeeds in killing, just like he did the first time, the faith in that his young version of himself had. He ends up succeeding in killing the child that he would have had, the family that he would have had, all because he would much rather be in this world of letters and books and judgment and all of this other stuff. Just
maybe a
like
little
John. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe a little on the nose, but by, what is the phrasing, wearing his actual wife down into aborting the child. He clearly is not with her in the future, so maybe a little on the nose, but by killing the wife and the child, you are kind of just showing all in one, a very alone man, you know?
Yes, no, exactly. No, I think that's the thing, and that is why it is Kevin Spacey, who, as John Doe, who says, that is my sin. I envy you in your perfect normal life. It is Somerset who envies Mills and his perfect normal life. And it is Mills who is wrath, who Somerset, as a young man, how did he exercise his wrath against this terrible, terrible world? By killing his own child, by ending his own marriage, by ending his own life, was how he exercised that wrath. So it's, again, when we get to the end of the movie, I know we're kind of all over the place with Seven, so this is just kind of, I guess, how we're doing it today, but because everyone's seen it, it's fucking Seven, you've all seen it. When we get to the end and the head in the box, the reason there's not a grisly shot of Gwyneth Paltrow's head in the box is because we're not really, it's not important at what point in the day did Kevin Spacey get into her apartment. It doesn't matter. This is hell. You can tell because it's a giant hellish desert with huge towers rising up everywhere. That's why we're out into the middle of this abstract potentiality, completely divorced even from the reality that it could be New York that we were in. That is why a strange messenger shows up with a box in defiance of reason. That is why Kevin Spacey is not dressed in prison orange, but in red, because he's the devil. He is the devil born of Somerset's sin and Somerset's lack of faith. He is there to now punish Somerset for all of these things. It'll allow him to see basically the death of his own faith in the form of Mills, to allow him to see the death of his own wife. So when Somerset looks into that box, he doesn't see Gwyneth Paltrow's head. He sees the head of his own wife. He sees the head of his own daughter, who Gwyneth Paltrow might as well have been because of the difference in age between the two, who are gone, and he is left alone in this, again, what might as well be a literal stage play, because it's just three guys in a flat plane. The devil, the young man, and the older version of the same man. And again, all cool stuff, especially for a movie about the seven deadly sins and what a sinful world we are in, full of sinny sins, and it hits all the bases that were hot in the 90s, from drugs to corrupt lawyers to S&M sex and all of the things that are definitely evil and part of sins and all of that kind of stuff. So cool movie and stuff, yeah. Anyone else's thoughts?
No, I was gonna say I haven't found a good way to kind of segue into this, but I keep wanting to figure out a way to bring up. We talked earlier in the podcast about just the really, really cool production value or the production look of everything, and one of the scenes that really stuck out to me was the sloth victim, just the number of car air fresheners.
None
of those were CG. None of those were all bought and hung. Yep. And you know, in other scenes had other very unique aspects, but I just distinctly remember him like moving the air fresheners and just cool, you don't see that very often.
Insane production design stuff, but especially choices like that. And I can say for sure In this crazy movie, that was the key sequence of the movie when people saw it in the 90s. That was the sequence that made you freak out, that made you go tell your friends that you need to go see something. There's this crazy part in the movie. As crazy as the whole movie was, and as crazy as the head in the box is as an iconic ending for the movie, the scene that made you go, holy shit, in the movie was Sloth. When you go in and there's the guy and you're just another grisly body, and we're way past the point of assuming that anything could be different, and we're just finding dead bodies at this point. All of the hanging air fresheners just tee everything up, and the moment that guy, when we're shining the flashlight on the guy's face and he goes "Gah!" and we realize he is alive. Just, it was a genuine holy shit moment that still plays really well in the theater, but there's just no way to compare it necessarily to what it really took you off guard in that moment, because
and the detectives react that way too. Yes. After that, and in the aftermath of that, them both sitting depressed, finally realizing the magnitude of what they are dealing with here.
Yes.
That's definitely the point where the movie shifts in tone.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, and that's what's cool is that, you know, and the film even points to the nature of the fact that, like, again, John Doe is the devil. It says, well, if John Doe is the devil himself, it would be disappointing. And the reason being that because everything is implied in this movie, that the killer, his plans, his who he is the film does such an incredible job of building to such astronomical heights that it's almost impossible not to disappoint in the ending with who he is. And yet the film does not disappoint. It delivers superbly. But just saying that that's in the first two after the first two deaths, you know, Mills and Somerset are still going back and forth about whether or not this is just some crazy guy doing stuff or whether or not there's something more meaningful or bigger that's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And it's that moment also where we realize the sort of grandeur, the idea that it's been going on for a year, and they even have a conversation to that effect. Imagine the discipline it took to tie a man to a bed and feed him for a year and do all of this other stuff. And it just amps up the entire idea of this, because there's a delimited context in which we assume serial killer bullshit happens, which is a guy opens someone's window, sneaks inside, and by the next morning, they've been serial killered. So all of a sudden, to have the idea that it takes it from a serial killer movie to a movie about some grand artistic endeavor being perpetrated by someone using people as the different pieces, because there's no the whole sloth setup may as well be an art installation. And essentially for a music video director like, you know, David Fincher, what a better movie to have than a series of art installations, the, you know, done in the style of Nine Inch Nails album covers, that are supposed to show the seven deadly sins. And that's essentially what we have, again, sloth, all the air fresheners and all that kind of stuff. And so I don't know, it's just at that moment, just the movie changes in that moment, but it also creates an impossible expectation for who John Doe could be. And part of the reason I say an impossible expectation is because things are more fun now in movies a little bit. They're not as good, but at least you can call in, like, you know, the devil or a demon or something. And that just wasn't happening in studio movies in the 90s. So I even remember, and I can still slightly feel this when watching this. Like I said, when we were reading about Seven in Fangoria, it was very rare for a movie that was going to be playing in the nationally released was actually in any way synchronized with Fangoria. So it was strange. Most of the stuff we read about was like Full Moon movies coming directly to VHS and stuff like that. So we knew that Kevin Spacey wasn't going to be revealed to be the devil. We knew that something that cool just didn't happen in movies. We knew that that couldn't, some weird pullback reveal, and in a good way, there wasn't going to be some bullshit reveal like this was all happening inside the head of a serial killer in an asylum or something, like Identity or some nonsense like that. So we didn't know that. So how do you fucking end the movie? You know, what's the ending? And I think that one of the things that's cool about the ending is the ending, as close as you can bring to literalizing, it takes us to hell, brings us to purgatory, makes John Doe like a godlike devil in his ability to just summon Gwyneth Paltrow's bodies. Head in a box, yeah. By having a demon just sort of show up and open it up, being able to have arranged for all of these things in perfect synchronicity in advance. Even the idea that they break into the sloth guy's apartment exactly 1 year after, which again speaks to the uncanny nature of everything that's happening. So he essentially at that point is, as near as makes no difference, a god, a devil, an avenging spirit, punishing Somerset, punishing Mills, in this crazy hellscape. And yet, even then, how do you pay it off in a satisfying way? And so we get eventually to the head in the box, which is, you know, the thing that most people associate, thanks to Brad Pitt especially, with his wonderful delivery of the line, "What's in the box?"
What's in the box?
The head in the box moment, which again is just great. You know, I will say this. I was just, you know, in the watching of stuff about Seven over time. You hear, and I've heard this story from a couple different places over time, but basically, that Seven, written by Andrew Kevin Walker, you know, had this insane, crazy head in the box ending. It was a lot like the film You See. People thought the script was cool, bought it, and then it immediately went through 10 rewrites that turned it into absolutely the opposite of what this movie is. So there was no head-in-the-box ending. It was much more of a cat-and-mouse game between a conventional serial killer and a detective. And David Fincher tells the story in a really interesting way, where he says that he was sent, by accident, who knows if it was a real accident or whatever, the original draft of the script. And he said he read it, and he said he was blown away. And he said, I started reading it, and I immediately stopped and called the person. I was like, I don't want to make this movie. It's just detective, serial killer. It's going to be a movie about, like, a guy sneaking up a fire escape and jumping into a police car. Meanwhile, his wife's drawing a bath while a killer jimmies the window open with a straight razor. And he says, I don't want to make... He says, this is a dumb movie. He's like, keep reading. And he reads, he gets to the head in the box, he says, oh my god, I have to make this movie. Calls up the producer, he says, oh my god, I love it, the head in the box, crazy. And he's like, what, head in the box? Shit, I sent you the wrong draft. That was the original draft of the script. There's been like 11 drafts since then. he reads the new draft that has much money, I'm sure, in Hollywood. And this is the unspoken thing, which I'm sure millions of dollars have been paid, or at least tens of thousands of dollars have been paid to writers to arrive at this new draft, where he said it was a script about guys jumping into the back of police cruisers and fire escapes, and a wife drawing a bath in a cotton robe while a killer jimmies open the window, who they catch in the end, and blah, 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 blah. And he says that's what it had become. And he said, I will make the movie, but I just want to make the original version of the movie. And that is ends up being what happened. So from naivete and from ignorance, you know, Andrew Kevin Walker writes the true version of the movie. He writes it all the way down the line. He writes a version that many wise people in Hollywood didn't want to make because they thought it would be too dark and too weird. And yet, it is what makes the film so, 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 so memorable. Yeah. I think even, again, I'm just quoting Fincher saying this himself at this point, but he says, anyone who's aware of this script prior was aware of it as the Head in the Box movie, and then everyone's trying to take the Head in the Box out of the Head in the Box movie. But what makes the Head in the Box brilliant, I don't know. We can just speculate as to all the different angles, but what I dig about it is the finality of it, the idea that everything is just like with all of the other bodies we've already discovered that are already dead. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about there having been a suspense sequence where he sneaks into Gwyneth Paltrow's apartment. It's not about her life being imperiled. It is about the finality of it all being over with already. She's dead. The head is in the box. It was just summoned. Again, they had every form of control they could possibly have over
There was helicopters,
distance, whatever. The objective mind, the rational mind, had every possible piece of control it could have over this man, John Doe, who then just snapped his fingers and Gwyneth Paltrow was suddenly dead and her head was in a box, and there it was. And the question then becomes, you know, that dilemma. Also, the fact that Brad Pitt never sees the head in the box prior to killing her. All of that keeps it not only in a finality that lets us know this isn't about saving the day, this is about a man, Somerset, dealing with sins that are already committed in the past. The things he has done are in the past, and now it is about atonement. It is about actually being punished for those things. So her life is not imperiled to be saved, just as in Somerset's world, she is gone. The wife has sailed. She is dead. That is what Somerset sees when he looks in the box. But the fact that Mills never sees it as well creates this interesting question, which is, if Mills doesn't kill John Doe and doesn't lose faith and keeps to his ideals as a cop and doesn't buy in to John Doe's bullshit. Because if you look on the whole car ride down, it is Mills' ignorance that protects him in a weird way, just like Andrew Kevin Walker writing the script. It is Mills' naivete that protects him from the poison of John Doe and even the poison of Somerset. Somerset and John Doe are very content talking about the evil of the world, and Somerset's principal objection is that Somerset, is content to not take pleasure in judgment of the world, and you know, Kevin Spacey is taking pleasure in his judgment of the world, and that's what differentiates them, which is kind of a gray and thin line to begin with. But it is Mills who's like, I think you're fucking crazy. I think this is all bullshit. And yet, in the end, Somerset and John Doe, without even showing them the head of Gwyneth Paltrow in the box, it remaining pure potentiality, it remaining a pure question, a what if, convince him to give up his faith, convince him to give up his principles, convince him to become this wrathful killer version of himself, and he shoots John Doe. So the question becomes, if he doesn't shoot John Doe, will that free Morgan Freeman from this 7-day purgatory that he's been in forever? If he doesn't shoot John Doe, and maybe he always will, then does reality unravel itself in a way where it wasn't Gwyneth Paltrow's head in the box, it was someone else's head in the box who looked like Gwyneth Paltrow, and Mills goes home to his wife at the end, and Somerset is somehow liberated to go into this retirement, this heaven, this paradise that he never, ever, ever will reach? Or maybe he will, after he's been through this a few thousand times, like Groundhog Day. He will somehow eventually try, he will successfully convince Mills not, because at the end, he's desperately convincing, begging Mills not to kill the guy, not to shoot the guy, even though he's been telling Mills the entire movie, even though Mills is the more emotional one and is the more wrathful one, whatever, he's been the one telling him what a sick and horrible and awful and twisted place the world is the whole time, you know, and yet all that has now just been crystallized into, metastasized into John Doe, who is an aspect of Somerset. And again, it's just, when he kills him, then I'll see you on Monday. Hey, what happened to that whole retirement thing? That's not literalized. That's not, we don't even question all that. He's just begins again. On Monday, Somerset will show up. The killings will begin again, and, you know, Mills's purgatory will go on forever and ever and ever. Or, sorry, Somerset's purgatory will go on forever and ever.
Not quite the point, and maybe a misreading or whatnot, but I remember watching the movie in the theater and just thinking, if you just stand in front of him, he can't shoot him. Like, if you just,
there you go.
Just be like, don't do it, man. Like, he's, I don't know. I felt like even then that would have been... And I've already having seen the movie, but I felt like that would have been even like a man to man bonding of like, just there's a joke between girls. You're not like this. Think about it. You know, look into my eyes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the only ending that allows him to escape, is actually standing in front of the bullet and taking it himself,
and then
he'll finally escape. Mm-hmm. From
and then he would finally achieve retirement and paradise at the same time. You
there
see, because that's his
there
only way out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. It's really interesting because we see that. We see those kind of ideas of everyone, the three men being conflated, the young and idealistic Somerset in Mills, and then the corrupted version of Somerset, his cynicism, which is John Doe, in the fact that all three men play house with Tracy at one point or another. So Tracy is the kind of meta wife of all of them in that way, in the sense that
we don't find out anything really particular about her, really, beyond just that
she
role.
Doesn't like,
yes, but beyond that, yeah, and she doesn't like New York. But I think that that's what's nice about the film, is that so much of the film allows us to fill in a lot of assumptions and a lot of humanity around a very things that are very sparse and very familiar, which are just detective movie archetypes, you know. Young detective, old detective, detective's wife who's waiting at home, who we know will hug him at the end of the movie in the blinking lights as he bleeds from his eyebrow, or whatever the thing is. It plays with those. We fill in a whole world around those people very effortlessly, such that, you know, we don't really think about how little is being literalized in the whole movie. We don't, as I said before, we don't think about the fact that they never say the name of the city. We don't think about the fact that we're not really sure where anyone's coming from or where anyone's going. There's other ways in which to point out Somerset plays the role of husband relative to
we
Tracy.
We don't look too closely at the fact that this guy's name is apparently really John Doe.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
He apparently literally has changed his name, or like, we never get what his original name was.
Exactly. No, all of that. The fact that his identity is completely ambiguous also points to the same idea. Like,
independently wealthy for unknown reasons.
Independently wealthy. Exactly. Instead of providing any kind of literalization to any of that, it is left abstract. And it can only do that by virtue of being a detective movie. We're so on board with, well, I'm a smart viewer, I know, old detective, young detective, I see where this is going, that we allow it to give us those characterizations, which are filled in a nuanced way by performance and by production design and by cinema, that gives us this robust sense of who these people are. But it remains very not, like we said at the end, Home Alone, to bring it back to Chris Columbus, is a very different movie if at the end of the movie the parents come home and are aware that that the kid just fended off burglars. Like, oh my God, Kevin, we can't believe you did this. It was nothing. You've got a little brave boy here, little young man. And the father punches out Marv or something. It makes it literally a movie about... Because now many people have witnessed this thing. It takes it out of the realm of potentiality into the literal, so it actually is a film about parents reacting to the fact that their child fought off criminals. by having them not see that and not literalize that, it makes it more abstract that maybe the only thing Kevin ever did was go to the grocery store and back, but to and talk to some guys in a van for a minute and then run inside and set up booby traps. But to him, it was one night, but it felt like a week, and it felt like this whole ordeal that he went through. And in the same way, the film, by not literalizing those things, is that just something cool and conceptual to do? No. By not literalizing those things, it keys us in. It allows us to experience the fact that Tracy is the wife, in essence, of all three men. That Tracy / daughter of Morgan Freeman as well. You know, and that, oh, there apparently have my ringer on. Let me turn that down. Boo-boo. There we go. Anyway, but in the sense that Morgan Freeman steps in and plays husband to her in the diner scene, mm-hmm. and then later on John Doe says, I went by and I played house with Tracy, blah, 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 blah. And what did he do? Well, presumably he did to Tracy precisely what Morgan Freeman did to his previous wife, an unborn child, which is cut them out of his life. He, you know, whether it's killing the daughter or whether it is divorcing the wife or whatever, it's born of that side of him that has emerged.
I was going to say, he did say that when he was describing, Somerset was describing his previous relationship, he said it was like a woman that was as close to him as a wife, but never actually, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So he had never even taken the plunge to marry the
exactly.
woman.
Exactly, yeah. So there you go. And yeah, and in that way, I don't know, it creates this interesting way in which everything about the film becomes very meaningful, including all of the insane, crazy production design, the things that are borderline uncanny, like the sloth guy. Excuse me. The things that are borderline uncanny, like the sloth guy being alive with his hand gone, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, them finding him a year later. His ability to orchestrate that entire scenario, his crazy, surreal hell apartment with black walls, you know, his wealth, all of these things, is because to the degree that any of those things are literalized, we no longer get to play with the idea that essentially he is the devil. He is the devil aspect of Somerset. He is his lack of faith. He is now that returned and metastasized as the demon that is going to punish Somerset and grind him through this purgatory over and over again. And that's why it's nice that he's independently wealthy and we never find out who he is or what his name is. It's nice that we don't know what the name of the city is. It's nice that we don't actually see the violence perpetrated on screen, because think about that as well. If we watched John Doe perpetrate the violence, then there would be an assumption, there would be questions like, well, so is he pointing a gun at him the whole time? Or like, what language does he use to convince them to participate in these very hell-like, appropriate purgatory-like things, like cutting a pound of flesh, you know, for the lawyer and all of that? Well, that's not important. That literalizes it way, way too much. We're just taking a tour of hell. It doesn't matter how in hell the devil informs the lawyer what he's going to do and how he's going to do it and the fact that he has to do it. He just has to do it because he's in hell. And by keeping it that abstract, and we're just literally, like in Dante's Inferno, taking a tour of all these different levels of hell, straight up to, in perhaps the most hellish one, the prostitute who's killed for lust, where we're literally descending down into a hell dimension where by the end of it, just like in John Doe's apartment, everything's lit with red lights because these things are subtle, all the way to find that, and literally feels like descending into an inferno-esque hell of writhing forms and all of that other kind of stuff. So anyway, what were you gonna say?
No.
Oh, I thought anyway. But yeah, anyway. So yeah, and again, and just so it's, I know it sounds like we're harping on this point too much, but it all is served by what isn't said, what is not literalized. The fact that we don't get into DNA tests and we don't get into someone's background, this or that. It is a police procedural, but it is an abstract version of a police procedural. It is an abstraction that is about contemplating, you know, the purgatory of this man who I'm sure on the surface doesn't view himself, and we don't view him as an audience, as being overtly sinful, you know, his sins are hidden deep below the surface in his cynicism and in his lack of faith that have caused him to commit these sins. It is not, we do not, when we observe Somerset, he's not drinking and partying it up.
Yeah.
He actually lives a very boring, isolated life. So what are the sins of this very boring, isolated man? Well, it's all right there in the opening minutes of the movie. We see his boring, isolated life. He doesn't have a wife, he doesn't have a kid, he doesn't have anything. And then we push in on his head, and then we cut to an insane Nine Inch Nails music video that goes on for 14 minutes or whatever the hell, with a remixed version of Closer by Nine Inch Nails playing over it, of people scrawling about sins in little books and recording things and looking at crime photos and everything. And that's what's going on inside of Somerset. That is the side of him that is awakening. That is the Tex Cobb in Raising Arizona to his Nicolas Cage. Mm-hmm. That is the dark devil figure within him awakening, because he's never confronted the things he did, and now he thinks he can retire in 7 days, perpetually 7 days, free himself from his own sins and never face those things. And yet not. So as we're wrapping up, Cliff, there is really only one thing left to do, which is we have to decide who in this film was the most jacked. Who gets the Full Metal Jacked Award for 7?
Well, in this movie where everyone is wearing jackets because it's all drippy and cold all the time, mm-hmm. where we don't see anyone jacked, I'm going to assume the answer is Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Why? Because merely 2 years later, mm-hmm. in another David Fincher film, mm-hmm. He would in Fight Club, Brad Pitt would have the famous super jacked look that every man wants to achieve. So I'll assume that underneath that heavy coat that he's always wearing, that the Brad Pitt is shredded.
Sick abs.
There aren't sick abs.
We know he had abs before it at some point. Thelma and Louise, we know he had abs afterwards, so as best we can infer, like dark matter, that he has abs in this
film.
That
sloth guy, over-dieted, too shredded.
That's right. This is true. This is
too
true.
Shredded.
That's true.
That's wild.
That's right. Cool. Dig it. Gluttony, had mass, not cut enough, unfortunately. Not cut enough. There's a conspicuous absence of jackness in this movie. I'm trying to think if there's any hiding.
No one really
in the
does
quarters.
Any big lifting.
Yeah.
No one really does any big heavy throwing.
It's not
a
movie about physically doing things.
Yeah, well,
it's
except for the chase scene between John Doe and Brad Pitt.
True,
so Brad Pitt participates. He chases him in that scene, and John Doe runs across some rooftops and shit in that scene. So,
parkour.
You know, he does do that kind of stuff. So now, and you can take that to the bank. You know that Brad Pitt is the most jacked guy
in the movie seven.
I don't know. John C. McGinley's in the movie, too. I don't know. He's taller than Brad Pitt. He's probably pretty built.
We can assume from his chin size, probably.
Yes, that's right. Oh, and we'll leave you guys with this. So apparently, John C. McGinley, who most of you know from Scrubs, playing the main doctor guy opposite Zach Braff. I don't remember the name of his character. Anyway, John C. McGinley was in this playing one of the SWAT guys, and apparently he improvised his line at the end. It was actually in an ADR studio that gets a huge we saw this movie in a theater, which we probably should have mentioned at the beginning, at the Alamo Drafthouse, and still we've seen Seven in theaters many times. It always gets a reaction at the end. Brad Pitt kills John Doe, and they're doing that cool helicopter shot of the three of them from high above, and the crackling radio voice of John C. McGinley in the helicopter has been kind of narrating and punctuating the scene intermittently up to this point. And as the camera's pulling away and the helicopter sound is whining, you just hear John C. McGinley go, "Ah, well, somebody calls somebody." And his line, "somebody calls somebody," gets a big laugh and reaction that finally breaks the tension of the entire sequence prior to that. And apparently he improvised that line because he was like, "I feel like I should say something," when they were doing that in an ADR studio. And he did a few variations on "somebody call somebody" or whatever the thing is. And I can say I have seen it in theaters several times. We saw it this time, and that scene plays to tense intense, focused silence. And I gotta say, Seven is a movie you gotta see in a theater for the sloth sequence, for the sequence at the end, because the emotions, the tension are 10 times what you could possibly experience at home. You are so much more dialed in. Plus, you get great moments like that where after being dialed the fuck in with 200 strangers, and it was a very packed screening we were in at the Alamo, everything was tension you could cut with a knife in the whole theater. And then when John C. McGinley goes, "Somebody, call somebody," everyone giggles. And then we're kind of cascading towards the end of the movie, and we're high-fiving each other, and people were throwing footballs and beach balls around the audience. And none of that happened, but that was internally, in the interior world.
You could imply that it was happening.
That's what it felt like at the end. We're like, we did it, guys. We made it to the end.
Yeah, Seven is definitely the movie that evokes everyone high-fiving and beach balls being thrown at the end of the movie.
For having made it through. Quite an experience. And that is really the unrelenting tension of that entire movie is kind of a bit released right then. And the remaining bits, including the very cynical quote about, who is he quoting?
The last quote.
Who is he? Who is Somerset is quoting a writer who says, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for."
Oh, Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway. He once said, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the
second part. With the second part. And I think that perhaps sums up Somerset's character, is that he will, his purgatory, his Sisyphean struggle, is that he is perpetually fighting for a world, but he doesn't think the world is worth saving, and that is why he will be stuck there forever. And that's why he will show up on Monday morning to find Mills ready to go all over again, which also
that
is an
poor woman,
which
just
by the way,
over and over again,
which by the way is an interesting read on his reaction to Mills at the beginning, is if you begin to view the film from Somerset in purgatory, he's just total boredom and indifference and just basically ignoring Mills as if he's a character on a TV. It's because maybe this is the eighth time he's had to go through this with Mills on some level, even if he's not conscious of it. Yeah. So anyway, anyhoozle, Seven, really good movie. I think we have talked it to death. Was really glad we got to see it in a theater and everything. Really glad we got to see two movies in a row that started with the number Seven. So let's find another one for next week, and we'll complete a 777 trilogy.
Seven.
That's right. Magnificent Seven could be playing. Seven Dwarves, Seven something or others.
We already saw Seven
that's
Samurai.
Right.
Boo.
So anyway.
Seven Seal, was that a movie?
Seven Seal we could see. Yeah, maybe that's playing somewhere. Anyway, all right. So until next week, y'all, I guess I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
And we'll see y'all in a crowded theater.
Once I was